Marty Moscoane, welcome to Radio Times. What's the first thing you notice about someone you have just met? Chances are it's their face. We look at faces all the time and make judgments about someone's personality and character traits. And we're probably the most critical when we look at our own face in the mirror or in photographs. Our face is a unique combination of features and wrinkles and skin tone and bone structure, which can reveal a lot about our emotions and our sense of self. Today on Radio Times, the human face, how it shapes identity and what happens to that sense of self after something like disfigurement or cosmetic surgery or even a facial transplant. We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Sharona Pearl is Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, wrote a book called About Faces, working on another book called Face On. And Sharona Pearl, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Jesse Taylor is director of the University of Pennsylvania's Craniofacial Fellowship Program, also co-director of Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania's Cleft Lip and Palate Program. And Jesse Taylor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, David Sarwar, professor of psychology and psychiatry and surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a consultant to the Center for Human Appearance at Penn. And David Sarwar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me, Molly.
David, let me begin with you. Do you think we see ourselves the way others see us when we think about our face or look at our face?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. And you know that?
That's one of the theoretical tenets that we really use to shape our work in this area, at least from the psychosocial perspective, which is we think about the psychological construct of body image, and one of the hallmarks of that is this notion that how we see ourselves in our own mind can be very, very different than the way the world perceives us. That sometimes the most attractive people will feel very uncomfortable with their physical appearance. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, we do deal with all the time with people with different degrees of disfigurement who find the resiliency to cope with those things and walk through the world with some amount of discomfort and distress, but do a remarkably good job of putting on the proverbial brave face.
Mm. A kind of dysmorphia?
Well, we see that sometimes with patients with cosmetic procedures who oftentimes will have relatively minor defects and they'll become obsessed and preoccupied with them. What we can see that level of preoccupation with someone who's disfigured, but there's a little bit more legitimacy to that disfigurement because we live in a society where we put such a premium on being physically attractive that we know, unfortunately, that if you look different from the norm as you walk around in daily life, you're likely to gather some unwanted attention.
Let me turn to you, Sharona. I'm just curious about your particular interest in the face, the human face.
Well, I think my interest comes from two different perspectives. There's the stakes for the face historically. How across time has the face served as an index to character? Have we imagined that our face has communicated ideas about ourselves? And then the other piece of it is knowing this or suspecting that people look at us and judge us. How do we then manipulate ourselves to present a face to the world? This is activated in interpersonal interactions all the time. We certainly try to look a certain way in different contexts, but there's also a number of media areas in which people very deliberately try to face and shape how their faces look. So how are actors make-upped and costumed in order to communicate certain things about their character? How do novelists describe the people that they're writing about in order for the readers to understand certain things about them? This is dependent on the audience having a consistent understanding, which isn't always true. So there are these very clear fault lines, some of which David was alluding to, and some of which happen because there's a mistaken sense that everybody looks at one face and feels the same way about it.
And makes judgments about it.
And makes judgments
all the time. How about for you, Jesse? Your interest in the human face?
Well, I think...
And you come at it from a different perspective.
Sure. In my work, I'm often changing someone's appearance. And that has very important psychological as well as physical ramifications. A lot of times people will ask me, well, what is the purpose of a face? And the one purpose of the face is to look like a face. And not everybody's face looks like a face. People make a lot of judgments based on your appearance that may or may not be true about your intelligence, your background. And so when someone like me is going to use surgery to potentially change somebody's appearance, there are a lot of ethical and psychological ramifications to that. And that's something that's certainly foremost in my mind, but isn't always foremost in the patient's mind. And I think it's one of my real important jobs before we do surgery is to make sure that somebody understands those.
And I'm assuming things like, what do you want to look like? Will you feel happier if you look this way? Will you feel more like who you think you are?
Sure. So there are limitations to surgery, and there are sort of the scientist/artist concept of appearance, and what limitations do I bring to the table, and what can I bring to the table to change appearance, and communicating that to patients can be challenging.
David, I also wonder whether, since we're always judging each other all the time, especially just as we pass each other in hallways or on the street, whether quote-unquote attractive people are thought to be smarter, nicer, you know, have all the sort of positive attributes.
Yeah, so we know through a large body of social psychological literature that tells us that more attractive people, those who are rated objectively as being more attractive, are not only perceived in a more favorable light, including on dimensions like intelligence, how much money they're making at their jobs, the other interpersonal characteristics related to kindness and empathy towards others. But we also have evidence that tells us that throughout the lifespan, they also receive preferential treatment in a variety of social situations, starting as early as the hospital nursery as newborns.
Like where a cute baby?
Cute newborns are picked up and held more frequently than those who are less attractive. We see it in elementary school. And as part of the conference we had back in November, we brought in Dr. Daniel Hammermesh, who's from University of Texas at Austin, who's done a tremendous amount of work on the impact of physical appearance on employment issues and salary, and conclusively has shown in repeated studies that more attractive individuals are hired at higher salaries and are often promoted more frequently. So we see this kind of bias, this beauty bias, unfortunately, across the lifespan. And then we flip it upside down and we talk about people who are disfigured, then we have to think, how do we help balance that? And how do we help those patients adjust from a psychosocial perspective in a world where there's that very high threshold already?
But it is interesting to think of one's identity. I'm looking at you, Sharona, and sense of self, whether we like our face or not, whether we are misjudged by our face or not. It is who we are, is it not?
Well, that's making a lot of assumptions.
It is making a lot of assumptions.
Because if our face changes, do we then become different sorts of people? If you suffer a terrible accident, if you're one of these candidates for face transplant surgery, have you somehow fundamentally changed your character in a particular kind of way? And I think that there's a kind of unconscious bias or consensus that says that, yes, you are changing your character in a particular way, which is why we have so much difficulty in some ways or pass so much judgment on certain kinds of people who want to get cosmetic surgery, why there was such a tremendous and now hard to remember media maelstrom around the first face transplant. It's hard to decode these texts when you go back, but it seems like there's a real fear, unstated, that if we change people's faces, we somehow are changing their character, which in and of itself is problematic. But the second piece of it is, if we change their character, how can we possibly ever trust the face as an index again? Because we do this. We might not admit it, but we look at people and we make judgments.
And a face reveals responses, one's emotional state. I mean, a face gives away a lot about what we're thinking or feeling at a particular moment.
Right. So that's the other piece of it. And that's the piece, I think, Jesse, you'll get into it a little bit more. But if somebody doesn't have a face, doesn't have the ability to respond emotionally, then that person really is disabled in multiple kinds of interpersonal interactions. There are these kinds of conditions, and again, my colleagues know a lot more about them, where people can't show expression,
right.
Where people can't interact, and they find it tremendously difficult.
Go ahead, Jess.
Yeah, it brings to mind Möbius syndrome, which is when someone is born without the ability to make facial expressions because their facial nerve, which powers their facial muscles, is paralyzed bilaterally most of the time. And so these are kids who grow up unable to show emotion. You can imagine how difficult it is for them to interact with their peers, potentially interact with their families. They look in repose basically normal, but you can imagine how much difficulty they have going through life.
Being happy, being sad, being worried, all the things that show up in our face.
They cannot express emotion in any way, so they cannot smile, they cannot frown. It's a tremendous challenge, and yet in repose, so if they're sitting in a room watching a movie, they look normal.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous way to go through life if you think about it.
That's, I don't know if it's true or not, but I think that's a kind of stereotype about Botox as well. And we've all seen those faces that are so, it looks like so injected or so surgery, you know, full of cosmetic surgery that they can't show emotion.
Yeah, it's interesting. When patients come to see me in consultation for aesthetic surgery, they often, the first thing they say is, I want to look natural. So they want to have surgery to change their appearance, but they want it to make they want to make sure that other people don't know that they've had surgery to change their appearance. And that's a thread that runs through aesthetic surgery, certainly, but also in the reconstructive world, it's there as well.
Is that true? But can you do that today? I mean, can you make someone look natural and, quote-unquote, better through cosmetic surgery or aesthetic surgery?
Yeah, I like to think that most of the work that I do is quite natural in its ability to rejuvenate the face in the aesthetic realm. And yeah, absolutely. I think it's possible to change somebody's appearance and hide the scars, if you will, so that others can't see them. I think a well-trained plastic surgeon can pick most of these things up, though.
Well, sometimes it's a game you can play watching television, you know,
trying to
figure out who has had plastic surgery or not. David, did you want to add to that about a minute or so before our first break here?
Yeah, I think both Jesse and Sharon have touched on something really important that's really evolved in our thinking at the Center for Human Appearance in the last few years, which is the face really does have a quote-unquote function, that it's that in changing the face through procedures, whether we're talking about the reconstructive procedures or the cosmetic procedures, this is something beyond just vanity, that our faces plays an important role in how we communicate with one another, the emotions, as you said at the start of the show, the judgments that we make of other people. And so we really try to advocate not only for our patients, but when we have to have discussions with the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, about the fact that enhancing appearance or improving appearance of somebody who's disfigured is a critically important thing. So when we're thinking about the patients with some of these disfiguring conditions, when we're thinking about combat veterans who are coming back from war who are dramatically disfigured, oftentimes they're quickly dismissed as, well, this is just about vanity. And the reality is when you can't express an emotion with your face or when your face is so disfigured because of injury, that does impact your functioning and quality of life.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And today on Radio Times, we are talking about the human face. And that's David Sarwer. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry and surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a consultant to the Center for Human Appearance, also at Penn. Sharona Pearl is assistant professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. And Jesse Taylor, director of the University of Pennsylvania's Craniofacial Fellowship Program, co-director of the Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania's Cleft Lip and Palate Program. A lot of University of Pennsylvania represented in this hour of Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send me a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Policy Studies that prepares students to take leadership roles in developing policies to address important issues impacting our communities. Students can choose from food and agriculture, sustainability and environment, or community and international development. More information about a Master of Arts in Policy Studies is available online at delval.edu/grad. As the calendar pages fall away and 2013 comes to an end, you might be thinking of how to get that last-minute tax deduction. Whether you make a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, in the new Hobbit movie, composer Howard Shore writes music for a dragon. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with David Sarwar, Sharona Pearl, and Jesse Taylor. A quick correction here. He's co-director of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Cleft Lip and Palate Program, and we are talking about the human face, taking a close look at the human face, what it says about our identity, our sense of selves, and what happens if you get a new one. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jesse, I am interested in the work that you do with children, and I'm assuming these might be children that were had an accident or perhaps born with some kind of disfigurement.
Yeah, most of the patients at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, cleft lip and palate and craniofacial program were born with a congenital malformation. So the number one congenital malformation of the head and neck is cleft lip or palate. Hemifacial microsomia, where one side of the face is smaller than the other side, is very common. And then we deal with a lot of kids who are born with misshapen heads, secondary to a problem called craniosynostosis, which is when one of your cranial sutures fuses early, which is an interesting condition in that it's probably the concept for instance, the Saturday Night Live skit, the Coneheads, came from. Because when one of your cranial sutures fuses early, you can have a misshapen head that looks like a cone head. You can have one that looks triangular in shape, parallelogram. There are lots of different sort of classic shapes. But you can imagine how parents feel when they've been awaiting a child for 9 months and it comes out and it's got an appearance-related difference in the head and neck and the emotions that carries with it. So a lot of the work we do is tremendously emotionally charged. Fortunately, we have wonderful surgical ability to correct or change some of these congenital appearance differences. So most of my work is tremendously uplifting for that reason.
David, I know there's a portrait program. Perhaps you could talk about it, and we will link to this on our webpage as well because it looks fantastic.
Yeah, so for the last several years, the craniofacial program at the Children's Hospital has partnered with Studio Incominati, which is a realist art studio and school here in the Philadelphia area, founded by Nelson Shanks, who's a world-renowned portrait artist. And what we've actually done for the last several years is we've partnered some of our children and adolescents in the program who have gone through surgical treatment with artists in training. And the artists have actually painted portraits of these children. And it's taught all of us who have been in the project, the families, the artists, the surgeons, the other medical professionals, a tremendous amount about the impact of the work that we do, the power of art and beauty as part of the healing process. We've now have 12 portraits which are done. The last four were unveiled earlier this November at an event we had at the Children's Hospital. And there's a video that is kind of a mini documentary of the program that is available both on the face-to-face program website, which can be linked to from either the CHOP website, which is chop.edu, or Studio Incominati's website, which is studioincominati.org. And it's a very, very powerful, incredibly well-done video about the history of this project and where we're hoping to take it.
And is the goal for these children to like the face that they have or to change the face that's more, quote-unquote, acceptable?
Yeah, I think there are actually multiple levels of goals here. On the one hand, we wanted to make sure that these are children who we thought could benefit from the experience, and I'm sure you've had guests on in the past who've had their portraits done, and they've talked about how powerful an experience that is, and particularly for these kids, because they're so used to being seen as clinical patients and not as someone who's beautiful or portrait worthy, as my colleague Scott Bartlett has referred to it. At the same time, we want to use this project as an opportunity to educate all of us about the importance of beauty and appearance in day-to-day life, and that individuals who are disfigured are not necessarily fundamentally different people on the inside. And so it's a project that in my time at Penn, in my top three list of things I'm most proud of professionally.
Did either of you want to add something to that, Jesse? Do you want to, just in terms of the kind of work that you do?
It's interesting. The Children's Hospital has been one of the first, and it's really been a leader in craniofacial and cleft surgery. And the list of people that have contributed to that goes on and on. But as David already mentioned, Linton Whitaker was the founder, and Scott Bartlett, the current chief, both are very prominent members of the craniofacial community. Don LaRosa is another very prominent member of the cleft community, who basically have been showing the world how to do this over the past 50 years. And this portrait project, to me, doesn't symbolize, well, is this a disfigured child or a child who basically has normal appearance, but it's basically pointing out we're all human beings with a lot of the very same emotions. I think a lot of the kids, when they see their portrait painted, feel the same way I would feel if my portrait were painted. And so the point
is that me?
Right. Is that me? Is that how I view myself? And when you think about appearance and you think about degrees of perhaps variability from the norm, I think the emotions that we feel in our appearance-related differences are all very similar, is my guess. And the degree to which it is truly a deviation from the norm probably has very little to do with how we feel about it. And so another way of putting that is I may see a young woman who basically is gorgeous but has a dorsal hump on the nose, and she will think about that in the same way that a parent may think about a child who's just born with a cleft lip. You may say, well, that makes no sense, but it's very interesting to me how emotional we get and how much our identity is wrapped up in our appearance. So even a small appearance-related difference emotionally is I think probably there's some equilibration over the population in that.
Is that vanity?
That's exactly what I wanted to get to. Jesse is pointing out here is that there's really a long continuum of how people feel about the ways that they look and the way that they appear to others. And it's really not specifically linked to what we might imagine are the markers of traditional or conventional attractiveness. So to label the desire to change how you look mere vanity, as opposed to vanity or anything else, is really misunderstanding the extent to which this affects the way that people feel about themselves. And I think the most important metric here is not how do we appear to others, with all respect to these questions of appearance, guarding you greater income and so on and so forth, but really how we feel about ourselves. And that's really what we ought to be thinking about. How does the face that we present to the world affect the way that we feel? And that is highly personal and has very little to do with the extent of the disfigurement or the nature of the problem.
But I also think we have the technology, the skills, the ointments, the whatever, to actually improve on our appearance. So we have the ability to do that. Then it raises a question is, do you do it or not?
Right. And this gets us into the incredibly tricky ethical realm and why there is so much pushback against, say, face transplants or certain kinds of aesthetic surgery, because there's a sense that people are cheating.
Right.
And this also becomes incredibly gendered in interesting ways that we can talk about. But we don't say this to children. We don't say you were born with a cleft palate. You ought to really just live with it. You ought not to try to improve your appearance because it's mere vanity. So I think what Jesse's pointing out is we really ought to think about these things as a continuum. One piece is not vanity and the other is somehow a disfigurement that deserves to be fixed. And that gets back also to David's comment about returning military veterans who have suffered in certain kinds of ways. And the military is actually one of the major funders of face transplants, even though no vets who have been disfigured on the battlefield have yet received face transplants. But they are very interested in, as it were, paying back the debt, which is a very different kind of narrative than just trying to suck it up.
There was an amazing piece in Time magazine about a guy named Bobby Henline who came back from, I'm not sure if it was Iraq, it was Iraq, and was basically sort of blown up, and he's now a stand-up comic. And there are these pretty vivid pictures of him, and he's missing parts of his body, but there he is out there doing stand-up comedy, which to me is probably, besides being a soldier, a Marine, the most courageous thing that a person can do. Put yourself out there. Jesse.
Two points that Sharona made, which I think are super interesting. One is, and I totally agree with, one is the concept of this being a continuum. When I woke up this morning, I chose to take a shower and brush my hair before going to work These are in ways I was aesthetically improving myself. Lots of people put makeup on before they get up and go interact with others. How is that really ethically or in some sense that much different than perhaps using a cream to make your skin less wrinkly, or and then if a little further down the continuum, having surgery to change your appearance? Mm-hmm. Well, it's all in my mind part of a continuum. And then I think the other interesting point is that I do think that we as a society make value judgments about what we consider to be acceptable aesthetic improvements and unacceptable aesthetic improvements. And I think it definitely affects the market for aesthetic improvements, if you will.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Jesse Taylor joining us along with Sharona Pearl and David Sarwar. And we're talking about the human face on Radio Times, the sense of self associated with the human face, what it says about our identity, how we are judged by others, and whether and how to change that face. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I wonder, though, David, and I'm looking at the three of you, I think I'm the oldest one in this room here, when you do get older, and if a lot of people are having surgeries and Botox and work done on their face, it does change the definition of what it is to look like a 65-year-old, for instance. I mean, it can. I realize most of the population doesn't do this.
Right.
But the stuff that we see in movies and magazines, right, chances are they've been touched up.
Yeah, and so you're really touching on two issues there, one of which is, you know, what percentage of the population is doing this. And I completely agree with Jesse that when we think about the range of treatments to improve your appearance, there truly is a continuum here. And within the last 10 or 15 years, where you've seen really the greatest movement in cosmetic procedures has been with the minimally invasive non-surgical treatments, many of which, if not most of which, are designed to push back the hands of time and are classified more as anti-aging treatments. Right. And I do think that there's a greater quote-unquote acceptability of those treatments for many individuals as opposed to undergoing the more typical surgical interventions of facelifts and blepharoplasties for the eyes and so forth.
Real Housewives of whatever.
Right. But I think, unfortunately, the media does these procedures a bit of a disservice, because when they are portrayed on Housewives of fill-in-the-blank city, or, you know, the latest show on E, I believe actually saw that there's a new one coming out called Botched, which is all going to be about surgeons who operate on patients who have had botched procedures. But anyway, I think what happens is we see the most dramatic examples and don't realize that the statistics tell us that most people undergo a single procedure and then return to their lives and are not, you know, they may come back for a procedure years later, but they're not undergoing these full body, you know, extreme makeovers on a day-to-day basis.
I'm also thinking, as the three of you were talking, that I think we all know people that wouldn't fit the sort of classic mm-hmm. definition of attractive, but they are attractive. And it's something about maybe their spirit, the way they present themselves. I'm looking at you, Sharona, that they just... And we're attracted to them because of something about their personality.
I think that's absolutely true. Part of it is what the film Kissing Jessica Stein called Sexy Ugly. Does anybody remember
that?
Which is certainly a classic case of people who are different in interesting ways. And even some of the most stereotypical representations of what we think of as attractiveness models, runway models, usually actually are odd in particular ways if you see them in person. So there's a lot of studies around this as well, that people have differential ideas about what would make them the right. most attractive. But if you saw a model walking down the street, all 5'10" of her with her incredibly skinny body and her probably slightly asymmetrical face, you probably wouldn't think of her as conventionally attractive in the same kind of way. Some of this is also the intervention of Photoshop and other kinds of ways. Nobody really looks the way that the most attractive people look. But to get back to the heart of your question, how is it that people manage to be attractive when they might not be conventionally attractive? This, again, speaks to Möbius syndrome and what Jesse was saying, which is that so much of what we're judging about other people isn't the strict ordering of their features. Mm. It isn't how high their eyebrows are, how symmetrical their nose is, and so on and so forth. It might be in photographs because their faces are still, but in interactions, the ability to communicate emotion, I think the ability to communicate personality and character is a huge piece of how we're drawn to others.
And eye contact as well. You've all mentioned face transplants at one point during our conversation, and I'm just, I don't, how many face transplants have been done worldwide? Does anyone know?
There have been 24 face transplants done worldwide. We think that the one, anytime we talk about vascularized composite allotransplantation, which is sort of the broad umbrella under which things like face transplant, hand transplant, perhaps abdominal wall transplant goes under, there's a little bit of hedging of the data because the one place where the data is not always readily available is China. And so I think there have been about 24, maybe 26 face transplants done. And the experience in the Western world has been quite positive, with the caveats being that I think as we get a longer-term experience, we might start to see some of these negatives or downsides to basically long-term immunosuppression, which naturally goes along with having a face transplant. And one other just interesting study that I think is maybe pertinent to any discussion on face transplant is one that was done by a guy named Barker at the University of Louisville a number of years ago, where he asked people, both within the transplant community, clergy, lay people, and then actually transplant recipients, how many life years they would be willing to give up to be given a new organ. And he asked them about a wide range of organs, including very classic transplant organs like liver, kidney, pancreas, heart. And then he added in face or hand. And it's very interesting that the results of the study were that people were willing to give up the most number of life years in order to have a face, a functioning face. By far, they would rather have a face than a heart, double, which is, in my opinion, very interesting, and it gives you a little perspective about the central role that a face plays in someone's life.
Indeed, David, can you answer that?
I completely agree. I think it really speaks to what we're really covering today in the show, is just the power of the human face, and that perhaps is the most profound example of all in the impact of our appearance and on our quality of life and day-to-day functioning.
And we're almost up in a break here, but since we're talking about identity and face, and I'll toss this quickly back at you, David, so if you have, what, someone else's face, is that what you get with a face transplant?
So that's been, you know, it gets back to Sharona's work in this area, the concerns about identity and identity transfer. All of the evidence that I'm aware of seems to suggest that because you're essentially, for lack of a better term, applying a new face on top of the existing skeleton or any repairs that need to be made to the skeletal part of the face, the resulting appearance is going to be a hybrid. It's nowhere going to be, it's not going to ever be as clean as in the movie Face Off with John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, where they just swap faces and their personalities stay the same. So,
well, let's take that short break, and Sharona, I'll toss that back at you after this very short break, talking about the human face in this hour of Radio Times. That's David Sarwar, professor of psychology in psychiatry and surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Sharona Pearl, assistant professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. And Jesse Taylor, director of the University of Pennsylvania's Cranial Facial Fellowship Program, a co-director of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Cleft Lip and Palate Program. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Wintertour presents Yuletide at Wintertour, a holiday tour of Henry Francis DuPont's ancestral home, now through January 5th. Tours will showcase Wintertour's traditional holiday displays, featuring interiors bedecked in holiday finery and decorated trees, including the dried flower tree, a Yuletide tradition, plus special exhibitions, shopping, and dining. Yuletide at Wintertour reservations at 800-448-3883 or wintertour.org. Wintertour proudly supports WHYY.
That's guitarist Jim Hall playing the Julie Stein, Sammy Kahn song, Time After Time. Jim Hall died Tuesday at the age of 83. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen back to our interview with him, and we'll listen back to our interview with the late lyricist Sammy Kahn. This year marked the centennial of his birth. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A call for kindness from people who were once strangers.
We know that many people will be thinking of our children and educators. and wondering how to help. We ask that you consider performing an act of kindness.
The families from Sandy Hook Elementary answer killing with kindness. We'll talk about it next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, again talking about how the human face shapes identity, our sense of self, what happens if we decide to get a new one, whether through cosmetic surgery or a face transplant. And again, our guests are Jesse Taylor, Sharona Pearl, and David Sarwar. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Sharona, you've written a lot and you're writing a book now about face transplants. How should we think about that?
Well, just to pick up on the previous question about if you get a face transplant, are you actually getting the face of another? I think this precisely highlights the anxieties that people have around cosmetic interventions generally and the face transplant in particular. If we're concerned that we will no longer be able to accurately use the face as an index, which is to say we can't look at someone and then judge them accurately, judge their character because they've changed their face in some kind of way, how much more acute is that concern if it's not only some kind of artificially imposed face, but the actual face of another person?
Right.
And this was, as strange as it may sound, the tenor of a lot of the bioethical objections to the original face transplant surgeries. And I think that partly, as David says, you're not really getting the face of somebody else. But what this really highlights is that we really, really, really want the face to tell us a whole lot about the person underneath it. Whether or not it does, or whether or not it tells us more about the people doing the looking and doing the judging and their own biases, I think is something that there's a lot of attention being paid to just at this moment. But I will say that this is a hot button issue that really touches at the very core of how we imagine we come to be people.
Sure. But even though we're only really talking about a handful of cases, and I'm assuming, Jesse, done under just extraordinary circumstances. I mean, someone's not going to have a face transplant unless there's a pretty critical need.
Right. And this really brings up the concept of risk. And is the concept of risk runs throughout surgery. How much risk is one willing to accept in order to achieve something in surgery? And the concept of risk is a very difficult one when it comes to face transplant. Often a patient has such a devastating injury and in some ways is desperate for a change. They're willing to accept any level of risk. So it's in some ways difficult to obtain informed consent in that setting, because if someone's in some ways desperate for a change, they'll accept any level of risk. And you can tell them, look, if you're on chronic immunosuppressive drugs, you have a 10 times greater risk of some sort of skin malignancy that may indeed shorten your life. Degenerative joint arthritis, you may have to have multiple joints replaced, and joint arthritis is incredibly painful. There are a number of other conditions that immunosuppression may lend to that would basically dramatically shorten your life. So you start talking about this concept of quantity of life and quality of life. And in someone who's perhaps a little desperate, it's hard to maybe communicate that as well as you might. And it was interesting. I was with Scott Levin, who's the chairman of orthopedic surgery at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also one of the world's foremost authorities in composite tissue allotransplantation or vascularized composite allotransplantation. He's the one who was the leader of the effort, the bilateral hand transplant at the University of Pennsylvania. He and I were looking at some of the results of the face transplants in the world. And I think both of us agreed that technically they actually fall short of what some people, I think, envision as getting a new face. And in this movie, in which John Travolta and Nicolas Cage were in, they basically look like normal human beings after a quote-unquote face transplant. Mm-hmm. If you look at the pictures of the face transplants that have been done, I would hazard to say that none of the patients looks like a normal person who's never had surgery. In some way, shape, or form, they all look a little different.
Well, it might be interesting to find out what they think about their face, right? Whether they're satisfied with the way they look.
Right. So all of a sudden, you're now, and this is a concept that Joe Losey from the University of Pennsylvania brought up. You know, you're taking a healthy person with no face or with a very bad face, and you're turning them into a chronic patient. because of the immunosuppressive regimen. And it's especially for a young, healthy individual, that's a very tough concept.
Indeed. If you don't mind, go ahead, Sharona.
Just really quickly, I think that the question of health, though, needs to be shaded in particular ways because, of course, there are major mental health issues associated with not having a face. In addition, if you can't eat because you haven't got lips and you need to have constantly be using other kinds of feeding mechanisms, that also has patient implications, infection implications, and indeed in the case of a lot of the people who have had face transplants, they had a number of other associated issues.
Indeed. Let me see what looks like Jim from Chester County what Jim has to say. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty.
Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
I want to thank your guests and your show. It's intelligent radio all the time, and
I really appreciate
the University of Pennsylvania today for their fascinating and expert views on things. Jim in Chester County. I've had two major car accidents with massive head injuries, and my left eye still kind of stares off into left field all its own, and I've got massive scarring on my left forehead and split through my sinus on above my left eye, and it's got like a scar that looks kind of like a star. And I was fascinated with your guest's view on the mental health issues because I had double vision for a while after the first car accident, and I had to wear split prism diopters, and the blanks had to be made special by Bausch & Lomb, so they were like the proverbial Coke bottle bottom glasses. So between wearing hearing aids, glasses, and having to walk with two canes, if I was with someone, people tended to speak to the person I was with as if I wasn't even there. It was really strange. And kind of affected my mental health, too, and my self-image. But luckily, I got over it, and it's not my problem. It's their problem. But it does affect your mental health in that you're almost not treated like a person. You're treated like an object. It's took some getting used to. I got over it. So it's not, like I said, it's not my problem. It was their problem.
Well, you know, Jim, first of all, I really appreciate you calling into Radio Times. You raise a number of interesting points, and I want to give David Sarwar a chance to respond to
your call. I think the last thing that Jim said is really powerful, and one of the things that we work to accomplish when we're engaged in psychotherapy with somebody with a disfigured appearance, which is to get them to realize that the problem is really with how people are responding to them and not the patient. Which is to kind of learn how to thicken their own skin and realize that despite their disfigurement and despite some of the unwanted attention, it's other people's problems, not their own, so almost to protect their self-esteem. Both Jim and Sharona touch on something really important. While we're talking about the face and disfigurement, and oftentimes, obviously, when we see that, we start to worry about things like post-traumatic stress disorder and depression and social anxiety. Oftentimes, there's a significant amount of psychosocial distress that goes along with the concomitant injuries. So if you lose your vision, if you have trouble eating and swallowing, if you have to ambulate with assistance, that's also going to impact your quality of life and have a potential to further exacerbate any of the psychosocial concerns related specifically to your appearance.
And we all had a kind of physical reaction when Jim was saying that people would talk to the person he was with and not with him, as if he did not exist, Sharona.
And I think that it is really to Jim's credit that he has been able to come and appreciate that it is other people's problem. But having said that, it really is other people's problem.
Yes.
It's a problem.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of studies, particularly in the emerging field of disability studies, to try to negotiate how people not ought to feel like they need to change, but the world needs to do a little bit of changing as well. And there's a scholar named Rosemary Garland Thompson who wrote a book on staring and how people stare at folks with disabilities. And certain kinds of people who have managed to embrace that staring as an opportunity to stare back and say, I am a person.
Interesting. Let me get, I know you want to say something, Jesse. Let me get Alex from, looks like media to join our conversation. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say that I've never been to war, and I have no idea what it's like to go through this sort of traumatic, explosive injury that you're discussing. What I did go through was 13 years of a normal life and being a regular kid, and then developing severe cystic acne when I was in my early teens, and when to a point where people would come up to me all the time in public. Usually middle-aged women would come up and say, my aunt, niece, whatever, granddaughter tried mayonnaise, egg, whatever, and it worked for her, which was horribly embarrassing.
Sure.
But then when I went to college, what happened to me several times was men, at least two, but usually in groups, would come up to me on the street and say, "You're ugly. Just so you know, you're really ugly." And it got to a point where, I mean, I know intellectually, I knew it was their problem, but it just absolutely devastated my self-esteem. I mean, I got to a point where by the time I was in my mid-20s, I could barely go outside and meet new people, and I had this image of myself that was just very, very different probably than what other people saw. I did go to the Center for Human Appearance, and I don't want to be a commercial for them by any means, but I had a series of dermabrasions, and people don't flinch when they meet me, and they used to. I think I'm probably average-looking, but I would take average-looking with gratitude. And the other thing that I noticed, I read a lot. I would throw into books a lot, and almost always the characters who are bad in the novel, thieves or con men, are described as being pockmarked.
Well,
I don't know why it is, but they're pockmarked and furtive. And I mean, it has a humongous impact.
I hear you. No, Alex.
It has a humongous impact. And there's millions of kids around the U.S. I mean, people don't pay attention to that kind of pain.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, or second of all, I should say, because I said this to Jim and I'll say this to you, Alex, thank you so much for calling into the show. And again, you raised a whole host of issues, and my three guests are all staring at me intently. Go ahead, Sharon, and then we'll get to you, Jesse.
Thank you so much, Alex. I have a lot that I want to respond to, but I will say that you highlight one really important issue that we always ought to remember, which is that most folks who get cosmetic interventions of one sort or another want to feel normal. It's not that people want to be the most beautiful. This is, a lot of research supports this. It's not that people feel like the bump on their nose stops them from being the most gorgeous human alive. People just want to feel like everybody else. And that's true of almost everybody. And I think that when we're thinking about people who make the decision to have cosmetic interventions, this gets back to the continuum that Jesse was talking about. Regardless of the severity of the problem, the emotions behind it are really quite similar. People just want to feel like they can walk down the street.
Go ahead, Jesse.
Alex, I really appreciate your comments, both on a personal level as well as professional. I think many of us, when we go through puberty, are faced with very difficult cystic acne, and it's one of our first challenges in life, potentially, of dealing with appearance-related concern. And just thank you so much for that wonderful call in those comments. And I'm going to be a little bit, I guess, redundant with what Sharona just said, because you made me think about something that's so interesting to me in my practice. There are basically two things that people ask me when they come in or portray. There's a group of people who want to just fit in. They don't want to be stared at when they're in a crowd. And then there's a group of people who want more attention. And it's so fascinating to me, the difference between those groups of people. By far, the overwhelming majority are people who want to just fit in. And actually, the second French face transplant recipient was a gentleman with neurofibromatosis. And his classic quote, and there actually is great video of this, is him crying to Christmas shop the year before he got his face transplant, and everyone was just staring at him everywhere he went. And then there was a video of him Christmas shopping the year after he got his face transplant, and he's staring at a window display, and there are hundreds of people around watching this, and nobody looks at him. So all of a sudden, he's just another member of the crowd. And for him, that was incredibly powerful.
I can only imagine. To you, David, she said something about when she reads in literature that the villain, the bad guy, probably the bad guy has a pockmarked face.
Yeah, that goes all the way back to, you know, some of the stories that we tell our children with Snow White and Cinderella and things like that. But the example I like to use, and I think there's a little bit of a nod to my son and our shared love of James Bond, is if you look through the history of the James Bond villains, from the earliest ones to the most recent ones, they predominantly are disfigured individuals. And while we may not always stop and think about that while we're watching the movie, if you just have been a fan of those movies or of movies like that, It's kind of the background soundtrack that you may not be really focused on, but the association of that somebody who's disfigured is evil gets into your brain. And as a result, we have those attributions. So when we see somebody who's disfigured on the street, we unfortunately then can be guilty of making the assumption that there's something evil or sinister about that person.
Go ahead, Sharon.
And this is actually a really old concept. It dates back to the Platonic idea of kallikogathia, which is basically...
I don't know what that is, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's basically the morally best, the most beautiful, the morally worst, the most deformed. And this is the consistent thread that weaves through all ideas about appearance dating back to antiquity. And novelists and filmmakers and other writers of media really do deploy this all the time, that the villains are ugly and that the heroines are always beautiful. And if they don't deploy that, it's because they're deliberately playing with us, because they know that we have this set of assumptions.
We are out of time. We could go on. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Sharona Pearl, thank you very much. Jesse Taylor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And David Sarwer, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Mari.
You're welcome. And all our guests affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania, David Sarwer, Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry and Surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine, also a consultant to the Center for Human Appearance, a Sharona Pearl, Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, Jesse Taylor, Director of the University of Pennsylvania's Craniofacial Fellowship Program and Co-Director of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Cleft Lip and Palate Program. We had many callers we could not get in on the conversation. What we appreciate those phone calls as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.